The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
Welcome to Thought Crime Radio. This is Janelle, and I'm in the studio with
Rich.
And we are the voices for the human rights of babies.
And we're trying frantically to get our interviewee online here. And in
the meantime, you can just talk. And what are we here for? Why are we here?
If you've been listening to this show since we started, we've, I think, fairly authoritatively established some fairly remarkable facts about the practice of obstetrics in this country. And one of the more notable things that we've demonstrated fairly conclusively, I think, to the open-minded listener, is that they are systematically brainwashing babies. They are alienating babies from their mothers. They're taking the babies from the mother, subjecting them to invasive and abusive treatments. Of course, they don't see it as abusive because they don't recognize what they're doing. But these treatments involve rough handling with abrasive washcloths and things like that, premature umbilical cord clamping, which robs the baby of a significant volume of blood and oxygen and iron, which is oftentimes reflected in subsequent IQ scores when the child starts school. Circumcision amputates the most sensitive erogenous part of the of the penis, which has it's a traumatic event for the baby, which is imprinted on babies. Babies imprint all these experiences, and the effects of these things can last a lifetime. And most people are completely unaware of how these things have impacted them. And so essentially what we're saying in short is that this entire society is suffering from a campaign, and not a conscious campaign, but a campaign of systematic brainwashing of and imprinting of children. And that's a remarkable thing, I think, to establish. But I think we've done a fairly good job.
I didn't hear much of what you said, but I'm back. And we have Dr. Fishbein on the line with us.
Yes.
Dr. Stuart Fishbein from the Los Angeles, Southern California area is a guest with us again this week for the second time. We're very excited to have him for three weeks. And Dr. Fishbein is the doctor who is, I call him the common sense OB. And I have colleagues out in that area, and he's the only OB that they will refer to when they want a birth that is gentle and science-based and a physician who's kind and supports the mother, father, and baby to all attach. And so we're really excited to have him back this week, and I'm trying to orient myself again. So you were talking about, before we bring Dr. Fishbein on, mm-hmm. I want to catch up with you. You were talking about why we're here.
Why we're here and what we've established, I think, over the past couple of months dealing with these issues.
Yeah, and a few times ago we talked to Pauline Dillard, Dr. Dillard, who talked to us about postpartum depression after surgical birth and how women can feel raped during their birth experience.
Yes, these experiences can be traumatic for birthing mothers as well.
And then last time with Dr. Fishbein, we talked about a lot of things, and we want to continue to talk about some of the things that are happening in his field and get his perspective on it. And we want to talk about informed consent. That's a big area of interest for Dr. Fishbein. And it's big in the news right now because the C-section rate is going up, the drug use is going up, there's a fight to keep hospital births going as opposed to midwifery births in the home as an option, and Dr. Fishbein is a huge advocate of the midwifery model of birth, which is the physiological model of birth. And that doesn't have to be in the home. That can be in the hospital or anywhere when you trust physiology. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about, with him, informed consent.
People don't realize that this country has unusually invasive obstetrical practices. In Europe, for instance, home births are the norm in most parts of Western Europe, and midwives are valued professionals, which are the usual person in attendance. Medical circumcision is virtually unknown in Europe, and when you tell a European that it's going on here
routinely,
even now it's
for cleanliness,
which is ridiculous. It's a self-cleaning organ, you know, just like the rest of the human body. It's like the eyelid or the eyes, you know. It's but in any case, they're horrified to find out that this is going on, and
that's sort of how you got involved in this. Right? You wrote the circumcision primer?
I got involved in it because I happened to stumble on these facts on the internet, and I would never have found out about it, and it would probably have continued to be an unconscious trauma.
And since August, we've talked to a lot of people, and every show, regardless of what we're talking about, circumcision is always a part of that, the mm-hmm. impact of that on the male and on the baby boy. And you've had some huge moments here on the air with just the overwhelming feeling of what it's done to you as a man,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and how it's impacted your current life and your whole life. And I've had those same experiences myself dealing with the birth of my children, in particular my first child, who was born when I was 18, and I was induced against my will. I was induced. I was told that they were going to give me a drug, and if it was true labor, it would get harder, and if it was false, it would go away. But I ended up like being on scopolamine.
That's a lie, right? I mean, they
lied
to you.
It's a lie. Yeah, yeah. My teacher Ray Castellino in California studies obstetric books. And he said there is no such drug. I was induced.
People need to understand that some of these practices that are common in medicine are just abusive. They're just abusive.
Well, I not only did not have informed consent, I didn't even have an option to not consent, to say no. And women right now don't have an option to say no. But I want to talk to Dr. Fishbein today about this. Because this is a common thing. My son was 25 years old, and I was watching a show about date rape that Oprah had done. It was a show about the show, and that was when I was able to put words to my experience of being drugged against my will and all the things that happened. I had scopolamine. I was tied down, and my mother was not allowed to come in the room with me. And when the nurse would leave, the door would swing open, and she would see me tied down, thrashing, and she begged them to let her come in because she knew she could calm me down. You know, and that's just the beginning, but it was like 25 years later. My cervix tore during the birth. And
most people in this country over the past century were
born this way.
Were born this way, yeah. Scopolamine is a hallucinogen. You go into a very ugly delirium. The whole purpose of scopolamine is to keep you from remembering the experience of the.
And you remember, it's like you. I woke up later. It's like the date rape victims talk about. They're one place, and then they wake up, and then you're beat up and bruised. My ribs were sore. I asked the nurses why my ribs were sore, and they said, "Oh, well, two of us were pushing on the baby." And I remember this. I remember when he was born because I came. I pulled myself up out of this fog of drugs because all I wanted to do was see my baby. And when I first started healing my birth trauma, that was what came up. It's like all I wanted was my baby. And it, like 25 years later, the bells, it was like the hallelujah choir. It was like for you when you found out about circumcision. It's like, this is why. This is why I have this issue and this relationship issue. And like as a woman, and in our society, nobody is talking about it. A woman cannot go back to her provider and say, "What were you thinking? Why did you do that? I felt raped when you did that. I felt violated when you did that." And I want to talk about that in terms of informed consent. And I want to get everything that Dr. Fishbein wants to tell us about his perspective of that.
I would like to mention two points of fact. One is that the neocons' definition of torture, you know, since the Bush administration came in and brought fascism with it into this country. Their definition of torture is where you have internal organ failure, and in fact, circumcision, medical circumcision, meets this criterion because about 50% of circumcisions in this country are performed without any anesthetic at all, and one of the possible complications of circumcision is gastric rupture. That's how painful it is. The stomach can actually rupture, so that's internal organ failure. The other thing is that circumcision involves a combination of pain and sensory deprivation. Much of obstetrics involves sensory deprivation of the baby and subjecting the baby to pain. And it so happens
And separating him from the mother.
Which is a form of sensory deprivation, yeah. And it so happens that this combination of the two, of pain and sensory deprivation, happens to be the CIA's recipe for psychological torture. Now, I don't know what that, you know, I don't know where this comes from, but I do know that the effects of psychological torture in Abu Ghraib are probably pretty similar to the effects of psychological torture in the obstetrical ward.
Yeah, and these drugs that are being used in obstetrical wards were never shown to be safe. In fact, there's something I just ran across this week. In 1978, the FDA Advisory Committee removed its approval of Pitocin for the elective induction of labor. The drug has never been approved by FDA for the use of augmenting labor. I was induced. I had scopolamine. I had gas. None of these drugs were ever.
Gas?
Oh, yeah. Ether. None of these drugs were ever shown to be safe. In fact, Rich just gave me a little publication called The Cultural Warping of Childbirth, and there is There are 100 references, and they're all from the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
And this is a very old pamphlet from the 60s. And
the effects of pharmacological agents upon the fetus and the newborn, American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, 1966. And I wanted to read several of these, and I'm going to post them on our blog, the thoughtcrimeradio.blogspot, because to me it just brings up the wounding. Rich and I both have talked about like the circumcision and the birth wounding, like the amount of loss is great. It's incomprehensible, and we think that that's one of the reasons that people are having such problems with attachment, such relationship issues, and are so vulnerable to mind control.
And this plays right into divorce rates and crime rates and drug addiction rates in this country. These things, you know, there are known connections.
And I bet Dr. Fishbein is really anxious to get on the air. So I'd like to welcome you, Dr. Fishbein, to join us.
Hi, Janelle. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
Hey. We're kind of putting you on the hot spot today.
Well, not really, actually. I was sitting back here just listening to you, your conversation. And, you know, I mean, I things, obviously, we have things to talk about in this era. Fortunately, I'm young enough that I didn't practice in that era. But I heard stories from my mother, too, about twilight sleep and putting people out and pulling all babies out with forceps and stuff when she was when she was pregnant. But you know, we have our own issues now. I don't think that the things that you're talking about as far as scopolamine and other things are still used these days, at least not in the environment that I've ever come across.
No, they're not, but now we have Cytotec and we have the Pitocin and the epidural. I mean,
oh, we have, yeah,
we've had
it's evolved.
Yeah, every decade has its drug, and because things are discontinued, I understand. Like, no, they wouldn't use scopolamine now, but there's a whole population of us who are like, but what happened to me?
But there are
the
still
principle is the same, right?
Yeah, there are still multiple generations in this country living with the imprinting effects of scopolamine on their births.
And it fits right into our conversation that we want to have with you and that I know you want to have for our listeners about a woman's rights to her body and informed consent. And along with that, the opportunity I want to add is for her to say no. And to be heard. Thank you.
Right. This is one of the biggest issues that I deal with in my environment every day. With practicing with patients and in trying to deal with third-party payers or insurance companies or hospitals or hospital staffs or medical staffs, part of hospitals or even societies, that medical societies, is that they all do pay lip service to the idea that a woman's body is her own to decide what to do with. They all have mission statements that they say things to the effect that a patient has rights, and we want to respect the dignity of those choices that a patient makes. But in practice, none of those mission statements are ever followed, because every day women are having options not given to them. They are given to them in such a way that they are skewed away from all the options that are available, and they are not told that they have the right to say no and still present to that physician or that hospital. They're just never told this.
What I hear is a lot of women say, and they said the baby could die, or this could happen, or that could happen.
Correct. That's part of what I would call skewed counseling. I mean, if all I told you was that if you got on an airplane, there's a chance it could blow up and you could die, and I didn't tell you that all the benefits of flying, you know, why would anyone get on an airplane? And it's the same sort of thing when it comes to, you know, the two topics that I know best, which are vaginal birth after cesarean or breech, is if you tell a woman who has these things that all that's going to happen is that she could rupture her uterus and her baby could die, and you don't tell her that a certain percentage are successful, that if you have a successful one, you're better off, that there are complications to surgical birth, but you just skew your counseling to get her to choose that, you're really not giving her informed consent or the right to informed refusal. And just because you and I may not choose something because we think the risk is too great, that decision really isn't ours to make for individual patients. I mean, it's almost Rich said it earlier. It's not a paternalistic thing. It's something where you feel like you know better. And maybe it is paternalistic or whatever, but there's a word for it. I can't think of it right now. But
authoritarian?
I'm sorry?
Authoritarian?
Well, yeah, that's a good word. Authoritarian or dictatorial, that we know best. I mean, you see it in politics all the time, but let's, you know, stay on topic, is that we know best and we think that this is what you should do, therefore we're going to skew our counseling to do this for you. And in the case of Janelle's birth and stuff like that, I mean, I can't speak for the individual cases, but I know that she is certainly not alone, even in today's world, for traumatic things that occur in the hospital without explanation, without really an understanding, without consent, without giving a patient true choices that do lead to lifelong scarring. I mean, and a mental scarring as well as a physical scarring.
Now, also, this type of attitude and approach to patients is really, it's taught in medical schools. This isn't just a spontaneous thing that comes up with individual doctors. This is a systematic issue in the institution of medicine itself.
Having been out of medical school for a while, I would, I can't comment specifically, but I can tell you that my inkling is that you're absolutely right. I mean, again, most medical students and residents are taught by full-time faculty that work at hospitals where, again, everything is a potential disaster, and they're taught with this model. And I think we talked about it last week, that the medicalization of birth teaches everybody who's involved in the training now that this is a disease to be treated, and that, you know, patients aren't that bright and they shouldn't really be making these decisions for themselves, and we can't really give them all the information because, one, you know, they'll choose wrongly because they don't have enough background or enough perspective. Two, they're not smart enough. And three, who pays me enough to take the time to tell somebody all these possibilities? I don't have the time. I only have 6 minutes to spend with you today, Mrs. Brown, so I don't have time to go over all these options. I'm going to streamline it to what I think is best. It is very paternalistic.
If you Google the phrase Appendix 50, Ethical Compromise, you will find a book called Heart Failure, which deals with medical school. This particular appendix starts out that the majority of 1,800 third-year medical students surveyed reported doing something they believed was unethical. One student admits, "What I learned was how to survive as a medical student by forcing myself to believe that what I was doing was right, when deep down I knew it was not." And it goes on from there. It's just case after case of scientific surveys, you know, statistical breakdowns of miseducated medical students being told to just throw their ethics away when they actually hit the street and start practicing medicine.
And I've seen the results of that are physicians who, for either that training or for just being just burnout, will get to a point in their career where they can rationalize in their own mind why they do what they do, and they don't think of it as a moral or ethical dilemma for them. They think that by rushing to get a woman who's 9.5 centimeters breech into the operating room and sectioning that, getting her on a table quickly and rapidly and sectioning her to get that baby out, they've done a good thing rather than giving her 10 more minutes to push the baby out. But they've convinced themselves that that's okay. So it's a process that goes from understanding when you're a medical student that some things are unethical, but not having the power to do anything about it, to eventually just becoming fully acceptant of it, or you become like me, where you become a bit ostracized, you become a bit radical. I guess they call me radical for arguing for, well, wait a minute, let's stop for a second and think. These decisions you guys are making, these policies, don't take into account what the patients want.
And
I'm looked at like I'm from Mars.
They're not even rooted in science. They're rooted in institutional biases.
Well, that's the point of the research that I had brought up here. And I wanted to add that when my ex was in medical school and my daughter was born in 94, he told me that the induction was safe and that epidural was great and it was safe. And it wasn't until about 8 years later I was doing the research, and I found all this research from the 80s and 90s about all the complications, and it told me that he did what he was taught and he believed what he was taught. And and it's not necessarily science-based, and that's what I want to connect with your
along that line, with your
informed consent. Like, there's, and maybe they don't go together, but I'm trying to make them go together.
I mean, in all fairness, we do hire our experts to be filters for us. Okay, if something's wrong with your car, if you trust your car guy, you don't need to be given all the options. He says, here's what you need to do. If you have a house with termites, you might do the same thing. You trust the termite guy. It's not going to go through all the different options. I know these may not be the greatest analogies. And the same thing goes with physicians. I mean, it's not practical to give every patient every possible option or scenario. I mean, with the web and internet now, people can seek their own information, however unfiltered it might be. But it's not possible to do that. And so, again, it gets back to the importance of how does someone know that they've got a practitioner or a hospital that has their best interest at heart.
Even doctors have this issue. Doctors rely on researchers, to come out with objective, scientific-based recommendations. And oftentimes these researchers are being paid by pharmaceutical companies or medical device companies.
Or governments. Right.
That bias their opinions. And it's a big problem.
Right. And for us, our responsibility is really to read through the study as best we can and try to interpret whether they've taken the data and used it properly. However, a lot of doctors really don't have the statistical skills to do that, nor do we have the time to read every article. A lot of what we read is just the blog or the blurb or the synopsis at the top of the abstract, what we call the abstract at the top, because we don't have time for all the reading of the details. So you're right. Everybody relies on information, and they hope that the information comes from a reliable source, at a trustworthy source. The truth is, in life, it doesn't. And we're all going to suffer periodically through our lives for this. But awareness that you guys are doing, bringing this stuff up, so people will hopefully ask questions. Because you're not going to change doctors' habits, but you can change doctors. You can find out if a doctor is willing to be queried by how they respond to your questions.
And for new listeners to this show, it needs to be pointed out that even if the outcome, seems good by medical standards, and the baby is born seemingly healthy and, physically well, the imprinting impact of these interventions may not appear for many years. And, if they do appear at all, but in many cases they don't appear for many years, and it could adversely affect a person's life.
And I agree with that, and I would tell you that often does not even enter into it's not even on the top 100 list of things that are important to the medicalization of birth in my profession in dealing with childbirth. I mean, you're right. I mean, so many things that we do, whether it's premature cord clamping, whether it's taking the baby away from the mother, whether it's circumcision, whether it's certain medications that they get, none of these things, no one ever considers.
Lack of breastfeeding or lack of support for breastfeeding?
Lack of support for breastfeeding or lack of just even the skin-to-skin contact, the eye contact, the initial bonding that goes on, the smell, whatever. Who knows what kind of imprinting goes on with that
in
the brain?
We know that breast milk immunizes against the bacteria that inhabit the skin of the mother. And so skin-to-skin contact between the mother and baby basically colonizes the baby's skin with the very organisms for which the breast milk immunizes the baby. So it's just a perfect situation.
And the passage through the vagina does same thing.
Yeah.
Babies that are born by cesarean section have increased rates of respiratory problems and childhood asthma, and it may all be traced to the fact that they're not exposed to certain antibodies or bacteria as they come through the vaginal canal.
Right.
Well, I want to let our listeners know that you're listening to 89.5 FM KOPN Columbia. We're talking to Dr. Stuart Fishbein, an obstetrician in the Los Angeles, Southern California area, and this is Thought Crime Radio, Voices for the Human Rights of Babies. And we're going to take a little break, Dr. Fishbein, for a message. And when we come back, I really have the intention for me and Rich to be quiet so that you can tell us everything you want the world to know about informed consent.
Okay.
Cool.
See you in a minute.
This program brought to you by listener support and a donation from the We Always Swing Jazz Series. KOPN is proud to be a sponsor of the We Always Swing Jazz Series Centennial Celebration of guitarist Django Reinhardt, featuring a performance by Mark O'Connor and his band Hot Swing at the Missouri Theater on January 21st at 7 p.m. More information and tickets available at Ticketmaster, WeAlwaysSwing.org, or 449-3001.
Non-permeable surfaces such as roofs or driveways direct rain onto our stormwater systems. During a rainstorm, large volumes of water are rapidly diverted into streams, causing erosion and water quality degradation. Installing a rain garden on your property will help improve stream health by filtering stormwater runoff and slowing its entry into the water system. More information on rain gardens is at www.moriver.org, M-O-R-I-V-E-R.org.
So, welcome back. And Dr. Fishbein, tell us what you want us to know about informed consent and what you're doing in obstetrics.
Okay, let me take a deep breath. Here we go.
We will too. Everybody take a deep breath.
Everybody sigh. Take it in through your nose, out through your mouth. And let's go. All right. Informed consent. Informed consent, by definition, is giving consent when you are informed of your choices. In order to have true informed consent, you must be given information. If you're not given the information, how can anyone give informed consent? So there's a real dilemma here because you can't possibly be given all pertinent information, but you should be given all pertinent choices and be able then to take that information and research it, discuss it with your doctor, discuss it with your other healthcare providers or practitioners, do some research on the internet, and come up with an idea what might be the best choice for you. As I said before, if you aren't given all the choices, how can you really make an informed decision? Once you've been given all this information, okay, you have the right to pick what you choose the best way to go, and that right should be honored. Okay? Now, the physician or the practice that you're in may not honor that choice. For instance, say you choose to have an abortion and you go to a practitioner who doesn't perform abortions. That's absolutely fine. But that practitioner shouldn't deny you the right to have an abortion or deny you the information that they are available. And somebody who's honorable will give you information of where you can go, and that works out just fine. But if something is skewed in such a way that you're not given information, like, for instance, my particular issue is breech delivery, and there is much data out there to suggest that selective breech deliveries are safe, but there are many doctors, most in fact, that don't want to do breech deliveries anymore, either because they don't know how, or they don't want to give it the time, or they're just scared or frightened, or weren't trained well in it, so they just don't want to do it anymore.
And for you, I want to just interrupt in case people didn't hear you last time. You said you want to, but it's the hospitals that won't allow it.
That's my particular case, but that's not. Again, we're trying to stick to informed consent. So What I do in my own practice is, if I have a patient who's breech and she meets the criteria for delivery, right now I have to refer her. I have to be honest and refer her someplace else, at least if she wants a vaginal birth. And some will choose to have a C-section, and some will choose to go elsewhere and have a vaginal birth. And I'm all for that. It's not proprietary on my part. I'm not trying to keep the patient so I can make the fee. It's not the right thing to do. But I think that there are many people out there who may very well do that and not give the information. So it really is not ethical for a physician not to give true informed consent. And if you pick a choice that isn't available in your hospital or your doctor's office or your community, then you have the right to look elsewhere, and the doctor really should help you give you resources to go elsewhere. The opposite of informed consent is called informed refusal, and after receiving options and maybe even a recommendation as to what, you know, some people will say, well, what would you do, Dr. Fishbein, and here's what I would. And I try not to answer that question directly. I try to give people an option and tell them that, listen, I don't have your life experiences. I don't know, you know, whether you have the same fears or rationale that I do, the same way of looking things. I don't know what your family situation, what your parents might say, what your husband might say. So I really don't want to make that decision for you. And if they persist on it and I give them a choice, they have the right to refuse that choice. And a good example of that would be, say, someone has a cancer and they're given an option of chemotherapy. And chemotherapy has a 95% five-year survival. Without chemotherapy, you have, say, a 85% five-year survival. But then you hear all the side effects of chemotherapy. Now, some people are going to choose to have chemo anyway and take that extra 10% benefit. And some people would say 85% is pretty good, and I don't want to go through that all, and I'm not going to. Either decision should be honored, and the patient should have the right to refuse treatment as well as accept treatment.
But here we're...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, here we run into the issue of proxy consent for children. You know.
Well, again, I'm not. I don't, you know, deal with that very often. So I would like to listen to your points of view. I'm sure your listeners would like to listen to your points of view on those sorts of things.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just.
No. I mean that's. That is, I know that's your thing, Rich, and I agree with you. Look at, we have issues with babies when they're born. You know, the hospital protocols are to give simple things like eye drops or vitamin K shots or, you know, vaccines in some cases and stuff like that. And, you know, patients have the right to choose not to do that. As far as consenting to do that, are they violating the child's rights? I mean, that's something that's way over my head and out of my league. But I can only comment on what you know, what I'm exposed to and what I've done a lot of reading and research and discussion on and gone to seminars and things about informed consent and refusal. And I just truly believe that there is a very big lack of respect for patient autonomy and patient decision-making in the medicalized Western medicine model, or medical model.
So with the example that you gave us with the cancer patient, do you find that the cancer patient is more respected in their decisions than maybe the woman who's laboring and they want to do a cesarean?
Yes. That's a simple question. Yes. Okay. People will document, you know, again, part of the whole thing, I, and again, we can't, unfortunately, ever go an hour without talking about the liability issue in medicine. Mm-hmm. I don't think you can ever go anywhere without it. I mean, I know Rich talked about it last time in regards to circumcision, and it permeates everything that goes on. And
it is a key to it, and I think that it, maybe next week that you could talk about that, tort reform.
I would love to talk about tort reform.
But
let's say with informed consent.
Right.
But before we get into tort reform, we need to address the question of what is going on with this information blockade in medicine. Why is science not prevailing in common medical practice?
I think it's the same reason that many things don't prevail in common sense in our lives in general. I think that there's, I think ideology trumps truth. I think that dogma or politics or expediency or economics, maybe economics might be the top of the list, Trump's truth.
Can you go back to your example of the cancer patient where you were going with that? Or the person who chooses to take the risks?
I think what I was trying to go with was the fact that a patient has the right to choose or refuse offered treatments. And Rich's point was it's probably more honored in a cancer patient than it is an obstetrical patient. Obstetrical patients, there's such fear of a bad outcome or litigation that women who choose to refuse an offered treatment that seems what the medical personnel would like her to do often is considered abusive, possibly unstable. They might consider getting a risk management person to come up. They might get a court order or a psych evaluation because a woman isn't choosing what they would choose.
And I don't know that
won't happen in chemotherapy because I guess the assumption is they're only hurting themselves if they're not following my advice to that effect. Whereas with the fetus, you've got to deal with a baby who can't really give consent, so it does cloud the picture a little bit. But you know, we have a society where the laws are very clear that the fetus does not have rights.
Wow.
Am I wrong?
That's pretty true.
Pretty true.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fetus, you know, it's really funny. If a 33-week fetus is born prematurely, the minute that baby's born, it has rights. But while it's in the uterus, it doesn't have any rights. It's just
actually, even after birth, babies don't have rights. You know, they can cut away pieces of their body with total abandon.
But in general, what do
you say? But in general, you know, I don't want to go to the extreme example of abortion, but you know, if a baby when it's outside is alive, born alive, and then something bad happens to it, it's called murder. And if the baby inside, it's not. And you know, if a baby is born with problems, they will do everything they can to fix those problems. But that same baby in utero, if the baby's having a heart rate problem or some problem that's a potential disaster, the mother can basically say, you know what, I don't want to be touched. And there's nothing, you know, legally that you can really do about it. I mean, you can get court orders and stuff like that, but it becomes very messy, and forced C-sections on people is not a good situation either. I guess we're getting to little extremes. We're not really going to the mainstream, where I would like the listeners to, because ultimately the whole point that I'm trying to make when I speak or when I write letters or blog is to help tip the scale to the point where, like in Malcolm Gladwell's book Tipping Point, it reaches a point of critical mass where people start demanding certain things. And in response to demands, there will be the American ingenuity, there will be markets that pop up that will respond to demands and give people an option that isn't currently available in the current model.
Actually, that's not going to happen in medicine unless they relinquish their monopoly on healthcare.
Well, why don't you tell us how you see that happening? The tipping point.
I'm sorry.
Rich. I love Rich because he brings up up the pragmatic truth.
I mean, it's a cartel. You know, it defines its own job description essentially. You know, they come up with this bogus research promoting circumcision, for instance. I mean, this is only one of many examples, and it's based on fraud.
What I was thinking about in the birth community was that if patients who are breech or have a previous cesarean section cannot find a hospital in their community or a physician in their community to take care of them, okay, some of these people are going to deliver at home, or they're going to stay out of the hospital.
And some of them are doing it unassisted now for that very reason.
And some people, if they assist them, are afraid of losing their license, so they're not going to assist them. So they're doing it unassisted. Now, obviously, this may, you know, I'm not commenting on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. What I'm saying is there, if the market becomes so rigid with currently available, Then a third option besides hospital birth, which is what we call medicalized birth or home birth, might spring up, and that would be a sort of I think we might have talked about it last week, but a sort of a surgery center type mentality for birth, where you have an institution that's not run by a corporate entity, it's not run by a hospital legal department, but it's run by physicians and midwives. Owned as a separate structure that has, obviously it's going to be government regulated, because if you have an operating room in it, so that you have to follow all the licensing parts of that. But you could have essentially a birthing center where women could have water births or walk around or have bonding as long as they want and don't have to sew up their episiotomy. I mean, not their, excuse me, their laceration. We don't do episiotomies, excuse me. Forgive me. But sew up a laceration, we don't have to do that right away. We can wait 45 minutes or an hour while the bonding's going on, because the doctors don't have to get back to their offices, and the patients don't need to be moved out of a room to clear it out for somebody else and move things along.
Yeah,
that whole mentality.
Rooms are not valued based on time, you know, dollars per hour or whatever.
That's right. If we can come up with something like that. Now, again, a couple things I could see getting in the way. Certainly, big hospitals are not going to like that competition, and they're going to do what they can with their powerful lobbies and stuff like that to make those sort of things either illegal or more difficult to get licensing for. Secondly, insurance companies and stuff like that, they'd be smart to pay for stuff like that, but they may not, so the economy may be such that people can't afford to pay for these things, because it would have to be out of pocket if it's not something that's licensed by an insurance company or authorized by an insurance company. And again, in order to have a model like this, you might not be able to deal with insurance companies, because they don't pay enough to make these things profitable. And, of course, they're not going to pop up if they're not profitable.
Well, you're surely aware of how difficult it is to keep a birth center running, and the birth center here just closed. So I'm wondering about that, but I'm also wondering about the whole notion of
Well, part of the reason that birth centers close is, again, the economics of it, because financially they can't make enough money on any given delivery.
Right.
A second reason is because midwives can't get a transfer agreement or a backup physician, and every state, of course, has different backup and supervising and licensing agreements for their midwives. But in our state, I know that if a midwife can't find any physician to back her, then she can't practice.
Is this something that could be essentially put in the patient's ballpark, and you know, with the assistance of the midwife, the patient would be the legal entity involved in, you know, approaching the hospital for this kind of arrangement?
You mean they get woman-centered?
Yes, exactly. Women's.
No, it would be lovely. It would be lovely to do that, and that gets back to my original point, where it's going to reach critical mass if enough women stand up and speak out for that. But my experience, Rich, and you know, and this is in defense of women when they have their babies, is, you know, when they're pregnant, they're not feeling well. They've got a million things going on in their body and stuff like that. And you know, being politically motivated or active is not their thing. And once they have a baby, same thing happens. They get very busy,
yeah.
And to organize this sort of thing, which is what we are trying to do here in Southern California with the Birth Action Coalition, along with a number of other organizations. But it's very hard to get people motivated once they're done having their baby, even if they had a terrible experience.
It's like painful to open that up.
Painful to open it up.
And people don't acknowledge it. I mean, it's
and people have other things going on in their lives that require more attention than that.
So what you're describing essentially is the free market as applied to newborn children, right? I mean,
I think if the free market were truly free, I think you'd have seen these things a long time ago. And I think you'd see birthing centers thriving.
Monopoly is what we have, yeah.
Right, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Wow. You know, it sounds really wonderful, and I'm thinking you're in California, so maybe 20 years from now it would... make it to the Midwest. But the other thing that I'm thinking about, and I always have to speak up for the baby, because that's my job, until you get caregivers who are also willing to see that it is the baby's birth, and it's the mother's experience of giving birth, so it's a baby mother-centered event, I could see how it would become more of the same.
You mean those centers would become like that?
Yeah, unless people are really conscious that this is a baby. This is a soul coming into this family, and it's the baby's experiencing it. The brain is online. The brain is recording everything, responding to everything.
Yeah, not only is the baby unable to speak for him or herself, they're being exposed to adults who themselves have been traumatized with their own births and their own experiences. And there is, unfortunately, a psychological mechanism called compulsion to repeat the trauma that comes through oftentimes in birthing situations.
I think that's true, but I'm not exactly sure how... You can't really solve that right now on a grand scale, but you can start to make changes, and I think that one of the changes with a center like this would be that it would be midwifery-centered.
Yeah.
And listen, I mean, there are midwives who practice like obstetricians, and there are obstetricians, of course, who practice like midwives.
Right.
But in general, I think midwives do a better job with normal birth, and the realization that you have two patients here, you have an immense amount of responsibility to respect process, and that the woman and the baby are in control of, not the practitioner. And this doesn't have to do. And again, some people would say, "Well, it's a, you know, obstetricians are male, and males don't get it, and stuff like that." You know, I mean, that's long been true. But about 85% of students going into medical or into residency programs in OBGYN right now are women,
mm-hmm.
and they're all taught the same way we discussed earlier in the program with the...
which is a male model.
The medicalization of birth. They're taught that, you know, how pregnancy is a disease and not a natural function. And you don't see that the nurturing part doesn't come out. It gets beat out of them, put it that way. Really does get beat out of them. Those poor students you talked about who've never seen a normal birth, who feel like they've done unethical things as a medical student or a resident, you know, when they make it out and they have the realities of life facing them, we all have to make choices in life. And sometimes those choices are really difficult. But we have to remember, again, that the decision-making process, the informed consent and refusal, belongs not to you, not to me, not to some institution or some trial lawyer. It belongs to each individual patient. And if we keep that in mind, we can, the other stuff will follow, I think. And if we keep reiterating it, pounding on it, and informing patients that this is the option that they have, to listen to the stuff, ask questions. If they don't feel their questions are being answered, seek information elsewhere. Find another practitioner. Look elsewhere. Make demands of your local hospital. If you know somebody on the board of directors of a hospital, ask them why they don't allow women the choice of vaginal birth after cesarean or breech. Why they have to be monitored all the time. Where is the data? As Rich said earlier, this is all, a lot of this is based on consensus opinion, based on not on scientific data, not even on common sense.
Yeah, it's not even common sense. You know, when you talk about respecting the process, people have a hard time with that, the notion of respecting a process. But what we're really talking about, I think, is respecting the baby. You know, the baby, yeah.
And the baby's connection with the mother.
Coordinates.
Yeah, and the whole labor. I mean, look, it's a biological process. I mean, mammals everywhere do this.
Yeah, babies coordinate the whole process, don't they?
Yeah, and they don't need attendance.
Yeah.
Most of the time. And you just leave them alone, and usually they go to a quiet place all alone to have their birth. They don't go to the, as I said, usually say, they don't go to the middle of the freeway to give birth. You don't see deer laboring in the middle of the freeway. They're in the woods someplace.
And they don't go someplace where there's going to be a crowd of strangers.
Or a crowd of even like-minded people. They're alone.
Yeah.
Okay? They're alone. They don't, you know, the buck isn't there. The other female deer or other does aren't hanging around. So she's off by herself doing what nature intended. No one taught her how to do it. She didn't read a book on pregnancy.
But she's essentially following a script that's been honed over millions of years.
Yeah.
And the baby, the baby itself is coordinating the entire thing. And when you intervene in something that the baby is trying to accomplish, you're telling that baby either that it's helpless or, you know, something's wrong with
it. And that's imprinted in the brain.
And that is imprinted.
Lives their life thinking, I'm helpless. I have to wait for the system. I have to wait for the authority to do something for me.
Babies, people that are born by cesarean apparently have a tendency to be passive.
Which is why I wanted to bring up what I did about this center that you create, making sure that it is baby-centered and that people know that this baby is experiencing the birth and will experience, if you're angry and you come into the delivery room, babies are sensory, they will pick that up. So I'm looking for a tipping point myself with that, and I think you're way ahead with your tipping point, and I really support what you're doing. I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's no sense for I mean, all the things that cause stress in a hospital setting that may transfer to the baby, who's screaming alone in an isolette someplace, down the hall from its mother. All those things aren't necessary, and the things that stress out doctors and stress out nurses and stress out, you know, don't have to be there. But it trickles down from the administration of these institutions on down. The pressures that are put on the people that are actually doing the work, I respect them so. I respect the people that do the work so much.
Mm-hmm.
But the pressure that's put on doctors and nurses and the ancillary people in a hospital, because the scrutiny and the big brother is watching and the memo here and the memo there and the charting here and the charting there and the you know, it leads to a tension that is palpable in a hospital setting, and it's certainly not conducive to a nurturing environment for a baby to be born into.
Now this is inherently traumatizing.
And you mentioned the baby that's down the hallway screaming, but you can look at video and pictures of a home birth, and there's the mother and the baby within minutes, and there are midwives poking at the baby, taking the mother's pulse, taking the baby's pulse, temperatures, you know, like all of that is a disruption.
Baby doesn't do it. Baby sits there.
The baby doesn't need that.
Well, no, they don't have to intervene with any of that stuff as long. You leave them alone when they're first born. But even when they do those things with the baby on the mother's chest,
mm-hmm.
the baby is calmer.
Yeah, it's It's much better than when they were taken away and they're even across the room.
Their eyes are open and focused and clear, and they're taking it all in. They're alive, you know. They're conscious.
And right. And you know what? They're still connected to their umbilical cord if they have to be. I mean, if it's just shortly after birth.
Born with you.
Well, most midwives understand that. And actually, delayed cord clamping is getting a little more press. It's still the standard that's taught everywhere. And, you raise the question, you ask why you cut the cord immediately after birth, and there's nobody who can give you an answer for that. There's no logical answer.
Because we've always done it this way.
That's right. It's the old Thomas Paine quote.
And I'm sorry, but we have about 4 minutes, and we actually only have a couple of minutes. I wanted to give you the last word about 5 minutes ago, because I want to make sure that you've said what you need to say about the informed consent. And then we're going to have to wrap up.
I do, and it's summed up in this quote that Thomas Paine says, which is, the habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it the superficial impression of being right.
Hmm.
And, circumcision, cord clamping,
drugs,
delivering a flat on your back,
All
these things, that's just the way it's done. No one thinks it's wrong because it's been done that way for so long.
And yet you compare that to a dog or a cat giving birth, and the contrast couldn't be more clear.
Right. Even other primates.
Yeah.
So, people could say, well, they're dogs and cats. Well, and they're mammals, and they give birth the same way that you do. Of course, unless you're a French bulldog, in which case you have to be delivered by a C-section, because I have a friend who raises French bulldogs, and they're bred to be too big to fit out of it.
Oh, my God.
But that's a whole other story, okay?
Oh, yeah. I'm just looking
that.
At Rich going, uh-uh.
Don't go there.
Well, so next week we'll do a story on, expose on French bulldog breeding.
Yeah, and traumatization of French bulldogs.
Well, actually, I hope that we can get to tort reform, because I know that's another one of your areas of interest and expertise. And we're talking to Dr. Stuart Fishbein from L.A., Southern California area, an obstetrician who is an avid supporter of midwifery, and creating a birth center that is separate from hospitals. We are so grateful for you joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Fishbein. Thanks.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for being here.
Next week. Okay.
Okay.
Have a good week.
You too.
Bye.
So this is Janelle for Thought Crime Radio.
And this is Rich.
And we are the voices for the human rights of babies, the people who don't have a voice.
Yes.
Say a little prayer. Every day, in every way, it's getting better and better. Busy making